All right, tonight, 1 Kings, chapters 5 and 6, as we continue to study of the reign of Solomon as king. Chapters 1 and 2 told us of the circumstances surrounding the death of David and the inauguration of Solomon as king. Chapters 3 and 4 that we took last time of the prosperity under the rule of King Solomon, how that they were at peace. There were no wars. With David, it was always fighting. He was a military man. With Solomon, there was peace, both inside of Israel, amongst themselves, as well as with all of their neighbors. There were no wars at all. In fact, there was so much prosperity, as we'll see tonight. Solomon is going to build the temple. The temple which God told David he could not build. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 7, he told David that he would not build him a house of cedar. But we know in 1 Chronicles that David told Solomon, his son, that he was to build the temple. In fact, it tells us that David collected the materials for the temple, had everything ready to go, and Solomon is the one who built the temple. And we are told two reasons in the book of Chronicles as to why David was not allowed to build the temple. One was because he had shed blood. And secondly, because he made war. And we will see tonight that Solomon is going to kind of take all of that and combine it into a summary statement. And basically, he is saying that his father David was so busy with war, and he was so busy defiling himself in that sense, with no time to build the temple. And so the building of the temple was left for a more prosperous time. In chapters 3 and 4 last week, we saw the prosperity. In fact, just to give you kind of a hint for the future, as we study about the building of the temple, this is going to be a beautiful temple. It is exactly double the size of the tabernacle, Solomon's temple. Gold everywhere, just, and the best cedar wood that they could find, the best of all the materials they could find. And this would eventually lead up to their undoing within 5 years after the death of Solomon, which is in 1 Kings chapter 14. But around 5 years after the death of Solomon, the temple was taken over, and in 586 B.C., it fell completely to Nebuchadnezzar when he came in. The Babylonians came in, and the temple was completely destroyed. Now, the temple in the New Testament is Herod's temple, not Solomon's temple. And it was after the captivity under Zerubbabel that they came back, and they took 46 years to rebuild the temple. But the temple was known as Herod's temple. Herod helped finish the temple. And that was Herod's temple, and that's the temple that was destroyed in 70 AD under Titus the Roman general. So we're here studying about Solomon's temple. This would be the first stationary temple for the children of Israel. They've been traveling, taking this portable tabernacle with them wherever they went, and now that there would be a permanent place. But because, when you build something out of your prosperity, and you put the best of everything into it, even with all the good intentions, somebody's going to want it. Somebody's going to want all that gold and all that wood. And there were nations that were collecting together to attack Israel for the purpose of getting that temple. So they set up for themselves trouble. Later on, we will see that in Solomon's compromise, that this prosperity is not going to last long. And the prosperity is actually going to defeat them. And it's kind of interesting, as Paul said in the book of Philippians, that he had to learn how to be abased and how to abound. You know, those are the lessons I'd love to learn. You know, we all say that. You know, if somebody dropped $1 million in my lap, some kind of a will or inheritance, love to have that kind of a problem. You know, love to have that kind of a test. But Paul said, I have to learn how to not only be abased, that is brought down to nothing and live on nothing, but I also have to learn how to abound. And prosperity can be just as big a problem and a curse to somebody as poverty. because we don't know what to do with it, and we go too far with it, and that was Solomon's problem. But at the end of chapter 4 of 1 Kings, it told us about all of Solomon's wisdom, that it excelled all the wisdom of the men of the East and of the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all men, than Ethan, the Ezrahite, and Haman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And this is important. He spoke of the trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals and of birds and of creeping things and of fish and of men of all nations. From all the kings of the earth who had heard his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Solomon was very intelligent. He was a biologist and a botanist, and he was a zoologist, and he also studied the fish, ichthyology, and as well as the animals and the animal kingdom. And when it came to build the temple, he had the knowledge of the wood and the metals that went into the temple area. He designed it. He took it off of the tabernacle design. And the wisdom of Solomon built this temple. It's interesting. Begin at chapter 5. Now Hiram, king of Tyre. We know when in David's days, again referring to 2 Samuel, I believe it's chapter 6, that Hiram was friends with David. And David went out and made political friends wherever he could. It says, Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon, because he heard that he had anointed him king in place of his father. For Hiram had loved David all of the days. So this is because of David, not because of Solomon, but because of David. Hiram loved David. And David had now died, anointed his son, and so Solomon sent his servants to him. Then Solomon sent to Hiram, saying, so this was a letter. Verses 3 through 6 is the letter that Solomon sent to Hiram, king of Tyre. You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God, because of the wars which were fought against him on every side, until the Lord put his enemies under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord, that is Yahweh my God, has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary, interesting in Hebrew, the word adversary is Satan, for Satan. Its original meaning was, whoever your enemy is, he's called Satan, adversary. And that's where the name Satan came from. Satan is our adversary. So he says, there is neither adversary nor anything evil happening. Boy, you talk about prosperity and peace within a kingdom. Both outside and inside, there's no evil happening. And behold, I propose to build a house for the name of Yahweh my God. Now there's a real interesting insight here. If you ever want to understand the temple, the Jewish temple, and of course the coming of Christ and relationship with Jesus Christ, is take this note in your mind, if not on paper. The temple, it didn't say it was for the Lord, it said it was for his name. The temple was a representation of all the truths that had to do with the Lord. And it represented his name. In fact, even the pagan worshipers would build temples to the name of their God, their deity. And so notice what he says here. I propose to build a house for the name of the Lord, for the name of Yahweh. In fact, the Jews respected the name of Yahweh so much that they did not pronounce it. They called him Adonai, which means Lord. That's why in the text it says Lord instead of Yahweh. It's because the Jews would not pronounce it. It was so sacred. So the temple was for his name. It was to represent him. And we'll see in a moment that God, in chapter 6, God does not dwell in temples. He never did, and he never will. It was, in fact, here's the main point about understanding the Jewish temple. It was not for people to go into and worship. There were sections of the temple, the courtyard area, even in Jesus' time. There was the inner court that was for the Jews, and there was the outer court. One court was for the court of the women, and another court was for the court of the Gentiles. But only the priests and those who officiated, served the Lord, went into the temple. The people were in the courts, but never in the temple. The temple was never for people to go in and worship. It was for the servants of the Lord. And the reason for it is, picture in your mind a king's palace. Do the common people on the street go into the king's palace? No. Just the servants and the household people are inside the palace. You might get a tour of it sometime, like the White House. You try to go stay overnight at the White House. You never happen. They'll take you on a tour. That's where the president and all of his cabinet and all of his officers and all of the people that run the government from within, that's what the White House is for. Well, the king's palace. You see, as we'll see next week when we begin chapter 7, Solomon's going to build himself a house. Well, you see, there's a house for God to represent him, and there's going to be Solomon's house, two palaces, one for God, one for Solomon. Well, the common people don't go inside the palaces. The temple itself, the temple proper, the inside of the sanctuary, etc., people didn't go into there. It was not like church. See, we have this whole thing with the building deal. It's only for the priests and only for those who ministered went in. All these people, after the temple was built, they came into the courtyard outside of the temple, never went inside. So he says, I propose to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, Your son whom I will set on your throne in your place, he shall build the house for my name. Interesting. It'll be for his name, not for him. We'll see in chapter 6 that God says, I dwell with my people, in the midst of my people, not in the midst of a building. He never has. He never will. Now therefore command that they cut down cedars for me from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants. And I will pay your wages for your servants according to whatever you say. For you know there is none amongst us who has the skill to cut timber like the Sidonians. The Sidonians is the reference to the Phoenicians. And so he's asking Hiram, king of Tyre, the Phoenicians, to send servants because they are experts at cutting wood down. They know the best wood. The cedars of Lebanon were the best woods. Now, at the end of chapter 4, we said David was a student of the cedars of Lebanon. He studied trees. And so he knows that Hiram loved his dad, so he's taken advantage of that situation. Thanks for sending the people to send condolences. And here's his letter back saying, provide servants for me. We don't have experts in wood, but I'm an expert at wood, but we don't know how to cut down the wood. The cedars in Lebanon, they withstood the wood rot, dry rot. They withstood insects. They were best for carving. They had all the qualities of the best wood to use in that area. And even to this day, the cedars of Lebanon are considered the best wood in the Middle East. So he says nobody can cut timber like you people, the Sidonians, the Phoenicians. So send servants to help out, and we'll provide servants, and we're going to build God a house. Verse 7. So it was that when Hiram heard the words of Solomon, that he rejoiced greatly and said, Blessed is Yahweh this day, for he has given David a wise son over this great people. Interesting, Hiram was a pagan. He did not worship Yahweh. He did not worship the God of Israel. In fact, in the book of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles, it tells us that he proclaimed Yahweh to be the creator of the universe, of heaven and earth. And so he is acknowledging that the God of David is a wise God, and he's given David a wise son over this great people. So Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, I have considered what you sent me, and I will do all you desire concerning the cedar and the cypress trees. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. I will float them in rafts by the sea to the place you indicate to me, and will have them broken apart there. Then you can take them away, and you shall fulfill my desire by giving food for my household. Remember, in his letter, Solomon says, I'll pay wages. Just send the servants. Now, all Hiram is saying is just provide their food. Don't pay him anything. And this does two things. It keeps the servants of Hiram out from underneath the control of Solomon. Because, you know, you feel loyalty to the person who's paying your wages. So you don't pay him wages. They still belong to Hiram. And it keeps Hiram keeps their loyalty. You have to realize that Hiram's not really throwing in with David. This is kind of a political scratch-the-back thing based on Hiram's relationship with David. Is that he was only too glad to help Solomon and to provide this. But, you know, the Phoenicians, the Israelites, would provide wheat and grain for the Phoenicians. And they're right there on the seacoast. And Solomon says, I've got a friend down there, Hiram, who has a navy fleet. They use the sea. So David sees a naval fleet that he could use if he had to. So they're kind of seeing the advantages to each other, and yet at the same time working with caution. Hiram wouldn't let him pay them wages. You just provide food for them, and I'll take, you know, those are my men type thing. Verse 10. Then Hiram gave Solomon cedar and cypress trees according to all of his desire. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household. Now a core is equivalent to 10 baths, that's a measurement, or in U.S. gallons, 60 gallons to a core. 60 gallons to a core. Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household, and 20 cores of pressed oil. Now, the pressed oil was the when you take olives off the tree before they're ripe and you press them and crush them, and that's what he gave them, the pressed oil from the olive trees. Thus Solomon gave to Hiram year by year, that is year after year, as this it'll be, we'll find out when we get at the end of the chapter 6, it'll be 7 years it'll take with thousands upon thousands of people to build this temple. So the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he had promised him, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon. The word peace is shalom. And the two of them made a treaty together. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all of Israel. Now we have to understand here, there's three different sets of people working this. The labor force out of Israel were the Israelites. There'll be a labor force from Hiram, who are the Phoenicians. They're the experts in wood. There's also a labor force out of the Canaanites, and they were the slaves who did the grunt work and all of the hard labor work. So Solomon raised up a labor force from out of Israel, and the labor force was 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. So they had you went for 30 days, and then you were home for 2 months. Not only to keep family together, because that was very important in Israel, but again also for loyalty. You don't want 10,000 of your people to be down there in Lebanon with the Phoenicians too long, because you can get influenced and sidetracked. So it was not only for family, but also to keep a rotation so that they're home for 2 months and then away for a month. You see, so the shift was going on with Adoniram as in charge of this labor force. Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens and 80,000 who quarried stones in the mountains. You're talking about a tremendous workforce. Not only do you have 30,000 down in the Phoenician working with the Phoenicians with the trees, but he had 70,000 just carrying things, the stones and all. And yet he had another 80,000 up in the rock quarries cutting and taking out the rock that was used for the temple. And these others were carrying the stones and all the materials into Jerusalem. Besides 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. So you had 3,300 supervisors. I mean, this took 7 years. This was a monstrous task. And the king commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, and hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. So Solomon's builders, Hiram's builders, and the Gabalites, that would be the Canaanites from Gabal, quarried them, and they prepared timber and stones to build the temple. Now in chapter 6, it describes the temple for us. In verses 1 through 10, it's going to tell us about the outer measurements and the outer building of the temple. Verses 11 through 13, God's covenant, and verses 14 through the end, through 38, the inner, inside, the interior of the temple and how it was built. So chapter 6, 1 to 10, the outer building of the temple. It came to pass that in 480th year after the children of Israel had come out from the land of Egypt, so 480 years later, from the time they came out to the time they started building the temple was 480 years. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign, so it took all this time to plan it and to make all the arrangements and to get things together. In the month of Ziv, some English texts say Zif, which is the second month that he began to build the house of the Lord. The Jewish calendar, the month Ziv, is the second month in their calendar, which would be June, around June time. So the fourth year that Solomon was reigning, and it was probably around June, that they began to build the house of Yahweh. Now the house which King Solomon built for Yahweh, its length was 60 cubits. Now if you might want to mark, if you're into note-taking, a cubit, I told you before that a cubit is the measurement from your elbow to the tip of your little finger. And just in common biblical measurements, most people give the cubit a foot and a half as a measurement. So it says, now the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, its length was 60 cubits. That means it was 90 feet long. Its width was 20. That made it 30 feet wide. And its height, 30 cubits, which means 45 feet high. These are all double the tabernacle area. So you got 90 by 30 by 45. The vestibule, which is the front porch. And by the way, this temple faced east, just like the tabernacle did. It was, except for the eastern side that faced, the front that faced east had a vestibule or front porch to it. And then on its sides, on the north, south, and west, there were second story chambers for the priests to live in, as we'll see in a moment. So you can kind of picture it in your mind. The vestibule in front of the sanctuary of the house was 20 cubits long, across the width of the house, and the width of the vestibule extended 10 cubits. So it was 30 by 15, the front porch, from the front of the house. And he made for the house windows with beveled or thin frames. Against the wall of the temple, he built chambers all around. Against the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctuary. Thus he made side chambers all around it. And that would be the three sides that are not facing east. That would be every side except the front. The lowest chamber was 5 cubits wide. The middle was 6 cubits wide. And the third was 7 cubits wide. For he made narrow ledges around the outside of the temple so that the support beams would not be fastened onto the walls of the temple. So he wanted them on the ledges and not fastened to the walls themselves, but resting on these ledges. And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone finished at the quarry, so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. That's kind of interesting. All of the measurements and all of the stones and everything for the temple, the stone was not brought to the temple area. It was all fashioned and formed before it got there, so that all you did was bring it and put it in place. There were no sounds of tools at the temple. Jewish history and Jewish tradition says that the reason this was is because to the Jews, they believed that God's work did not involve man's ingenuity. It's kind of a traditional view, but I think it's kind of interesting. That man's tools heard at the temple site would indicate man's efforts. And so the temple site would represent God in his name, not man's efforts and works. Verse 8, the doorway for the middle story or stage was on the right side of the temple. They went up by stairs to the middle stage and from the middle to the third. So he built the temple and finished it, and he paneled the temple with beams and boards of cedar. And he built side chambers against the entire temple, each 5 cubits high. They were attached to the temple with cedar beams. I said it was 2-story. It's actually 3-story chambers. Now, verses 11 to 13, God's covenant with Solomon. Then the word of the Lord came to Solomon, saying, concerning this temple which you are building, if, this is conditional, if you walk in my statutes, you execute, that is, you do my judgments, you keep all my commandments. The word keep in Hebrew, shamar, is to treasure up, to guard. So if you keep my commandments and walk in them, then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David. And I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. So it's conditional. God says, I will keep my word of blessing that I promised to David if you walk in my statutes. So you actually have to do it. You have to guard my commandments, is what we've been studying in the book of Proverbs, that God's word and his commandments must be a guard over our hearts. We must stay in them continually and guard his commandments and make sure that they have the influence on our, we're constantly hearing them and constantly fellowshipping with them. He says, then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David. So the question comes up, well, if they rebel against God and don't keep his commandments, does it mean that God will not keep his word? There's a qualifying statement. God says, I will keep my word, which I gave to your father David. Now, if they rebel, God's still going to keep his word, but not the one that he gave to David. He's going to keep his word by bringing judgment, you see. God always keeps his word. But he says, if you want to experience my word, the blessings that I gave to your father David, then you must stay in my statutes and commandments and judgments. And you must do them, you see. And you must guard them in your heart. But notice here, this is the key, verse 13. And I will dwell amongst the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people Israel. The Hebrew phrase, I will dwell among the children of Israel. That's a very key thing to understand in what these chapters are telling us. These chapters are describing for us how Solomon built the temple for, not for the Lord, it was for the name of the Lord. God did not dwell in the temple, a temple in which the people could not go into. You see? God says, I will dwell among my people. He was with the people themselves, not just in the temple. Now, why is this important? This is why it's so important in Jewish history about the New Testament. You remember Acts chapter 7 when Stephen was being stoned? right before he was stoned. You know why they stoned him? It was because of blasphemy. He says, do you realize that God does not live in a temple made with stones and made by men's hands? Because the temple is his footstool. He was making reference to the dedication of the temple by Solomon as it's recorded in the book of the Chronicles. And even at the coronation of the temple, Solomon says, let's get this understood. That this temple is God's footstool. God does not dwell in temples. He dwells with people. Now that has been since day one. But the Jewish people made the temple sacred, almost as sacred as God is himself. And the people themselves said, if you speak against the temple, you die. That's how sacred it was. Now, if you go to John chapter 2, this is the interesting thing. If you go to John chapter 2, Jesus, standing in front of Herod's temple, which was built on the same site as Solomon's temple, in John chapter 2, at verse 19, Jesus said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And they said, 46 years was this temple in building. And do you say, tear it down, and you'll build it up in 3 days? And that's one of the things they used against Jesus at his trial. We heard him speak against the temple. Same thing against Stephen. We heard him speak against the temple, you see. But the text in John chapter 2 is telling us that he was not speaking about Herod's temple, but he was speaking about his physical body, you see. You destroy this body, the body of his temple, the temple of his body, you see, not the building, even though Herod's temple was destroyed under the judgment of God. Now in Hebrews chapter 4, and I just want to read to you a little excerpt why all of this is important. And it's from the book of Hebrews, which is the book written around the first century, and it was written to the Jews. In Hebrews chapter 4, when it's talking about Jesus Christ, verse 14, seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast to our confession. Interesting, they're calling Jesus Christ our high priest, who has passed through the heavens. And the writer of Hebrews is presenting the throne of God as the Holy of Holies, which is the holy place inside the temple and the tabernacle. But now we're talking about heaven, you see. It was a type of what heaven's like. So Jesus Christ, who is our high priest, has passed through the heavens. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So, he's making emphasis here. This is something the people could not do with the temple. Only one person could go into the Holy of Holies in the temple. And it was the high priest who went into the Holy of Holies once a year at the Day of Atonement. That's it. When he would offer up a sacrifice, he would pour blood on the mercy seat for the sacrifice of the entire nation. And they tied a rope around his ankle, and he had bells on his ankle. And if he did not offer up a sacrifice that was well-pleasing to the Lord, the priest died. So they tied a rope around his leg, and if they didn't hear the bells, they would pull him out. They know he had died. But he was the only one allowed to go in there, you see. And those who were in the tabernacle, the temple area, not the Holy of Holies, because that was the temple area was 60 feet long. Remember, it's 90 feet long. The temple area was 60 feet, and the Holy of Holies was 30 feet. And inside of the Holy of Holies was the mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant, you see. And so only the priests went into the temple area. And only the high priest went into the Holy of Holies once a year. People were not allowed to go in there. See? They had no fellowship with God inside the temple area. Do you realize what Hebrews is saying to the Jews? I mean, the tremendous thing is that you can come straight into the Holy of Holies to the high priest. To the high priest? We're standing outside waiting. The priests are inside with the rope, and the high priest is inside the Holy of Holies. He says, no, you can go straight to the throne of grace. You. Jesus Christ broke down that curtain. You remember what happened when Jesus hung on the cross and died? That curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the temple area tore in two. It took maybe 100 people to hang that curtain. And it ripped in two because when Jesus died, He broke down the wall of separation between Himself and the people. You no longer had to go through a priest. You can come straight to God. Yes? While I was saying it, it has escaped my mind. More than that. Yeah, the curtain itself was very thick. It took almost 100 people just to hang the thing. It was huge. I doubt it. Because it was at Passover time. It was. Well, somebody had to. Not in the Holy of Holies or the temple? Temple area, yes. Not Holy of Holies. But the temple area, of course. They would have had to witness it. Just rip right in two. It was just miraculously. It was God showing that He has removed the curtain, come straight in, you know. But it's not a building. The temple that Jesus was talking about was His physical body. That when He died, you don't go through a priest anymore. You go through Jesus Christ. He is your high priest, you see. That's why the text in 1 Kings chapter 6, at verse 13, He says, I will dwell amongst the children of Israel, not in the building. And that's what Stephen was saying in Acts chapter 7, is that you make sacred the building, the physical building. That's why Paul picked up this in 1 Corinthians 6. He says, our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. Here's the temple of God, right here, your physical body. You watch how you conduct yourself when you're inside the physical building that you call a church or a synagogue or a temple, you know. You watch how you conduct yourself and you make sure that you do not defame anything inside the building. And there are a lot of people, and we've done it in this church, where people say there ought not to be piano playing inside the sanctuary. It's only for the service to God, you see. Well, to a certain degree, that's true. You don't do common things. You know, you don't set up a bingo parlor inside the sanctuary during the week because it represents the name of the Lord. But God doesn't dwell inside this building. He dwells inside people, see. It represents the name of the Lord. Therefore, all the activities should represent His name, you see. But people make the building sacred. But see, when we leave the building and we go back home or we go back out into the world, what Paul is saying is you corrupt your bodies. Just because you're away from the church building, you think, okay, it's okay now that I can be corrupt. No. You are the temple. Everywhere you go, you take God's temple with you. He's living inside of you. This is the temple right here. This is where you have fellowship. This is where you come into the Holy of Holies, you see. Not the building. Not the physical building. So verse 14, now verses 14 to 38, the interior of the building. So Solomon built the temple and finished it. And he built the inside walls of the temple with cedar boards. From the floor of the temple to the ceiling, he paneled the inside with wood. And he covered the floor of the temple with planks of cypress. Then he built the 20-cubit room at the rear of the temple, from floor to ceiling with cedar boards. He built it inside as the inner sanctuary, as the Holy of Holies. That's literally in the Hebrew. Kadash, the Holy of Holies. That would be the 30 feet. You have 60 feet of temple area and 30 feet of the Holy of Holies. So the first area is called the Holies, the holy place. And the Holy of Holies would be the 30 feet behind the curtain. And in front of it, the temple sanctuary was 40 cubits long. The inside of the temple was cedar, carved with ornamental buds and open flowers. All of it was cedar. There was no stone to be seen. So even though they put a stone foundation and stone walls, you couldn't even see one stone. It was just all cedar wood. And he prepared the inner sanctuary inside the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold and overlaid the altar of cedar. So Solomon overlaid the inside of the temple with pure gold. He stretched gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. The whole temple he overlaid with gold. The entire temple was overlaid with gold. Until he had finished all the temple. Also he overlaid with gold the entire altar that was by the inner sanctuary. Inside the inner sanctuary he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. The cherubim is a type of angel, and these two cherubim would be over the mercy seat. Each of them having two wings. It's going to tell us that one wing is going to touch the other cherubim's wing, and the other wing is going to touch the wall stretched across. One wing of the cherub was 5 cubits, and the other wing of the cherub, 5 cubits. 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other. And the other cherub was 10 cubits. Both cherubim were of the same size and shape. The height of the one cherub was 10 cubits, and so was the other. Then he set the cherubim inside the inner room, and they stretched out the wings of the cherubim so that the wing of one touched one wall, and the wing of the other cherub touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. Also he overlaid the cherubim with gold. Then he carved all the walls of the temple all around, both the inner and outer sanctuaries, with carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. Now, can you imagine this massive structure? All the inner walls were cedar wood, and the finishing touches was he engraved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers throughout all the walls on the cedar wood. And the floor of the temple he overlaid with gold, both the inner and outer sanctuaries. For the entrance of the inner sanctuary, he made doors of olive wood. The lintel and doorposts were 1/5 of the wall. The doors were of olive wood, and he carved on them figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, and overlaid them with gold, and he spread gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. So for the door of the sanctuary, he also made doorposts of olive wood, 1/4 of the wall. And the two doors were of cypress wood. Two panels comprised one folding door, and two panels comprised the other folding door. Then he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them, and overlaid them with gold applied evenly, or smoothly, literally, on the carved work. And he built the inner court with 3 rows of cut stone and a row of cedar beams. Then it tells us, in summary, the building of this temple. In the 4th year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which would be equivalent to our November, December, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its details and according to all of its plans. So he was 7 years in building it. 7 years with all these thousands of people, exactly as Solomon had detailed it. The exact measurements of the tabernacle doubled, and nothing but cedar wood and gold and carvings in all the wood. It was a beautiful structure, and it took 7 years to build this great structure. And next week, we're going to get into the study of Solomon's house itself. He built and some of the implements for the temple, but he built his own house after he built the temple so that he would have a house for himself. And he could not live in his house and know that God did not have a house to represent him. But we have to understand this. If we understand now how this fits together with the New Testament and how the Jews, and how, in a religious sense, they made the temple be sacred and be God, in a sense. And if you touch the temple, you are touching God. And that's why they misunderstood what Jesus said. That's why they stoned Stephen, because he spoke against the temple and he blasphemed. And he says, no, you don't understand. God does not dwell in houses made with hands. These buildings are his footstool. He's everywhere. And Paul, picking up this very Jewish religious approach and applying it to the Spirit, to spiritual truth, that our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. The building is not a temple. Our bodies are. The temple represented his name. It was for his name, not for him. We will see in succeeding chapters that all of this prosperity and putting the best into the building is what attracted the enemies, and the prosperity of Israel is what was brought them into compromise, which eventually brought them into judgment. And the temple was overtaken and eventually destroyed, first of all, within 5 years after Solomon died. When he died, civil war broke out, and within 5 years after that, the temple was seized, and then 586 BC, it was finally destroyed. And the enemies wanted to get in there and burn this thing and melt all the gold and everything down and take all the gold and the precious stones and the valuables out of the temple. So the enemies now wanted to conquer Israel just to get the temple. Look how much it's worth, you see. So it brought a lot of trouble for them. We will see that as we go through how this all fits in. But we need to understand that the building is not the temple. It never was. God never intended it to be that way. It meant to be a representation of his name. We are the temple. See? And we ought to treat it as holy and respectable. We also represent his name and him, except we have him inside of us. See? Let's close with prayer.